Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 7.
For Plato, then, political decisions and policies are philosophical at their core. There can be no ideal state or just life without understanding the principles of political philosophy. And understanding these principles requires us also to understand what knowledge itself is. This need extends not only to politics, but much further. Everything that matters in human decisions or judgments depends on the difference between truth and falsity, between knowledge and ignorance. The need for making these distinctions is even more urgent because, as Plato insists, knowledge is not related only to an individual or a group. For Plato, the difference between what is true and what is false is more than a matter of subjective opinion. Plato criticizes this subjective or relativist view of knowledge and values. This view had been made popular in Athens by the Sophists, a group of itinerant teachers. The Sophists proposed to replace the certainties of religious and social traditions by a new conception of values and knowledge. According to this concept, truth and values are no more than human creations. They are not objective or natural. Certainly, they're not fixed and permanent, as Plato held. The Sophists said these things could change in any way people might decide. This was a new and startling idea for a society in which tradition was the basis for most beliefs. The Sophists are sometimes looked back at almost as revolutionaries. They were, in effect, the first humanists. They believed in the power of man to construct his own world, his own institutions, his own commitments. Plato recognized the importance of their challenge, but the challenge was a threat that needed to be opposed. For Plato, the belief that humans invent values and knowledge is both practically harmful and philosophically indefensible. The major themes of Plato's thought, including the theory of forms and his ideal republic, reflect his opposition to the Sophists. Protagoras, the most famous of them, summarized their position memorably.
Man is the measure of all things, of those things that are, that they are, and of those things that are not, that they are not.
Against this doctrine, Plato argues that knowledge and values are objective, that they are fixed independently of the knower. For Plato, knowledge and values are real in themselves. It's important to understand exactly what's entailed in the Sophists' concept of knowledge, because Plato's reaction against it is the basis of his own thinking. This dispute is, in fact, the focus of another of Plato's dialogues, the Theaetetus, named after a figure in the dialogue with whom Socrates converses. The dialogue opens, as so many of them do, with a question. What is knowledge? Socrates asks Theaetetus. And Theaetetus, like Meno, responds not with a definition, but with several examples.
I think that all the things one can learn are knowledge. Geometry and all the sciences, and then there are the crafts of the cobbler and other workmen. Each and all of these are knowledge, and nothing else.
Socrates predictably answers that he's searching not for examples, but for a definition. He chides Theaetetus.
Suppose we were asked about some obvious common thing, for instance, what clay is. It would be absurd to answer potter's clay and oven maker's clay and brick maker's clay.
Theaetetus quickly catches the spirit of Socrates' questioning, so quickly, in fact, that he wonders at Socrates' power as a teacher in contrast to his own pain as a student. This gives Socrates another chance to describe himself as a teacher. This time, he compares a teacher and a midwife.
My art of midwifery is in general like that of the midwives who deliver children. The only difference is that my patients are men, not women. And my concern is not with the body, but with the soul that is in travail of birth. And the highest point of my art is the power to prove by every test whether the offspring of a young man's thought is a false phantom or one that is full of life and truth. heaven constrains me to serve as a midwife, but has debarred me from giving birth. So of myself, I have no sort of wisdom, nor has any discovery ever been born of me.
So Plato reminds us that a student must discover in himself the knowledge he seeks. Theaetetus then tries once more to answer Socrates' question.
Well, Socrates, with such encouragement from a person like you, it would be a shame not to say what one can. It seems to me, then, that one who knows something is perceiving the thing he knows. So far as I can see at present, knowledge is nothing but perception.
When Theaetetus says that knowledge seems to be perception, he's already applying his own definition. Socrates quickly associates what Theaetetus both says and does with Protagoras' claim that man is the measure of all things. Theaetetus has restated Protagoras' belief that truth is determined by the way it seems or appears to each individual. Now the chase is on. Socrates criticizes Protagoras along several tracks. The main direction of his criticism is what's known as a reductio ad absurdum argument, showing that the consequences of a statement or a position lead to absurdity. For example, Socrates contends that if Protagoras were correct in saying that each man is the measure of all things, then no one is wiser than anyone else about anything. This would mean that a layman's opinion would be as sound as a physician's about treating an illness. Someone with no special knowledge at all should have as much to say as the wine grower about planning his harvest. He should be as expert about composing music as the musician. In fact, Socrates points out, if Protagoras is correct, no one can ever be mistaken about anything.
Aren't you surprised, Theaetetus, that all of a sudden you should turn out to be as wise as any other man or any god? Must we not rather suppose that Protagoras speaks in this way to flatter the ears of the public?
If everyone's statements are equally correct, even when two people contradict each other, they must both be right. In fact, if many people say that Protagoras is mistaken when he claims that man is the measure of all things, their statement that he's mistaken would be correct. In fact, if the majority rules, then their view must be more correct than Protagoras' original statement.
Protagoras, admitting as he does that everybody's opinion is true, must acknowledge the truth of his opponent's belief about his own belief where they think he is wrong.
But would Protagoras take a vote to find out whether man is or is not the measure of all things? Socrates wonders. It's something of a mystery, in fact, why Protagoras bothered to say that man is the measure of all things at all. He could just as well say that the baboon or the pig was the measure. They too, after all, are capable of perception. If Protagoras puts people ahead of animals, he must assume that people have knowledge beyond the perception that they share in common with animals. And Protagoras can't say this without contradicting himself. Then, too, there's the irony we see when Protagoras poses as a teacher and recruits students. How can he do this if indeed everyone's opinions are equal?
If no one is entitled to say whether what another thinks is true or false, where is the wisdom of Protagoras to justify his setting up to teach others and to be handsomely paid for it? And where is our need to go and sit at his feet when each of us is himself the measure of his own wisdom?
Socrates had evidently been waiting a long time to launch this attack, but he contends that his attack is fair to Protagoras' doctrine itself. In one way, of course, Protagoras' claim makes sense. If someone says he feels a certain way, cold or warm, that statement can't be disputed. No one else can judge better than he what he feels. But to say that all claims of knowledge are like this statement leads to absurdity, according to Socrates. Socrates insists to Theaetetus that if knowledge is merely perception, it doesn't matter what the perceived object is. Indeed, objects wouldn't be objects at all in the ordinary sense of that word. They would be changing continuously into their opposites, since they would have to agree with both of the contradictory views that different people held of them.
There would be nothing constant here. A thing would not be white, but would have to be always changing into another color. We could not even give it the name of one color rather than another. And this is no more seeing a color than not seeing it.
These impossible consequences, Socrates argues, prove that Protagoras' theory and Theaetetus' own first definition of knowledge are inadequate. Knowledge may begin with perception, but it's not limited to perception. Man is undoubtedly the measure of some things, but of other things, including the most important ones, he is not. There is also one final reason, in Plato's view, for holding that knowledge is more than perception. Even when we speak about perception or sense experience, we say what we see or hear through the senses, not only with them. How otherwise would we coordinate the senses? How could we recognize that an object we see is indeed the same object that we touch or taste? Socrates says there must be something more at work here than the senses themselves.
Take the sound and color of a particular thing, Theaetetus. Have you not a thought which might include them both, which tells you that they belong to the same thing? Through what organ do you think all this about them? What is common to both cannot itself come to you by hearing or by sight alone, but only by a mind, or whatever it is to be called.
That mind, of course, would not be perceiving, but thinking. Socrates believes Protagoras couldn't make this distinction without contradicting himself. Theaetetus is persuaded by Socrates that whatever it is, knowledge is not merely perception. He then goes on to propose two further possibilities. The first of these is that knowledge is true opinion, a possibility that Socrates quickly addresses with a vivid analogy.
Let us suppose that every mind is a kind of aviary, stocked with birds of every sort, which stand for pieces of knowledge. When we are babies, the aviary is empty. Whenever a person acquires any piece of knowledge and puts it in the aviary, we say he has learned the things of which this is the knowledge.
But what's missing from this birdhouse is a way to explain how we are able to pick out the particular bird we want when we want it. What is that knowledge? And so the second hypothesis, although advancing beyond the first, also fails, soon to be followed by a third and final one. In this sense, the dialogue as a whole doesn't answer the question from which it sets out. Neither Theaetetus nor the reader learns what knowledge is, but they will both have learned something about what knowledge is not. And this clearly is an important step forward for learning about anything, including knowledge. The distinction between perception and knowledge is especially crucial here. Only by distinguishing between perception and knowledge can we separate the person who has knowledge from the object of knowledge, between the knower and the known. Once this distinction is clear, the way is open also for understanding the differences between belief and knowledge, between appearance and reality. All the distinctions that are needed, Plato claims, to prove the validity of his theory of forms. We can now clarify how Socrates' arguments in the Theaetetus are related to the theory of forms as it appears in the Republic. The theory of forms fundamentally distinguishes between perception and knowledge, and it makes two basic claims related to that distinction. The first of these claims is that whatever is known must be apprehended by more than the senses. Second, the object known has to be more than just a stimulus for the senses. What knowledge is about must be independent of the knower. It must be objective. It must be real. Plato concludes from this starting point that only something like reason or the mind can know. And what the mind knows must itself be rational or intelligible. Even ordinary experience tells us what the objects of true knowledge are. We make sense of the jumble of things and of the qualities we encounter in everyday life by finding patterns or common features among them. These patterns have general names: courage, or justice, or bed. But general names would make sense only if reality itself is organized in the way that they describe. These general terms, again, correspond to the forms, the universal and objective standards which exist independently of any particular instances. The forms also are independent of space and time, in the same way that a definition exists outside the pages of any particular dictionary, and also apart from all dictionaries. The forms are necessary, according to Plato, if we're to make sense of the plurality and the confusion of the apparent world. And he concludes, we do make sense of it.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.